Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
So I am Mary Toomey. I have a master's in social work. I have learned everything I know about public health in the last 24 hours, but what I have learned has made me realize how very, very important it is that we join forces across sort of the aging, the caregiving, the public health world to continue to elevate the elder justice, the profile of elder justice in this country. So I am at the University of California, Irvine, and I co-direct there the Center of Excellence on Elder Abuse and Neglect. And as well, we are also the grantee from the Administration on Aging to be the National Center on Elder Abuse. And just a word about that, and then I'm going to be asking all of you briefly to let us know, what was it about this topic that interested you? We'll do that quickly, anybody who's interested in letting us know. So in the Older Americans Act, the National Center on Elder Abuse is described as the authoritative voice. It's like
the authoritative voice on elder abuse.
I kind of need to practice. Is this even on? Yeah. So, but we take that very seriously. We take that mandate very seriously. And the other thing what we do is to make sure that we have our finger on the pulse of everything that's going on and related to elder abuse in the U.S. and actually internationally as well. For example, Canada is doing a lot better about elder abuse from a public health perspective than the United States is. So we also, you can come see our booth. We are booth number 3006, where we have things like research briefs on abusive people with dementia, abusive people who live in long-term care, abusive people with disabilities. We also try to reach older people themselves with some prevention tools, how to not find yourself a victim of abuse. So come on down. We also have M&Ms. So we've been very popular. We are also extremely interested in building partnerships at the national level with communities of color, with folks who are reaching caregivers and folks who are reaching physicians and other important gatekeepers. So some of this is also what we can do for you. We have a National Center on Elder Abuse listserv that anyone who's working in the field can join. We have an e-newsletter. We have other resources for you. So come visit us online or visit us where you can get M&Ms. So just a moment, anybody who wants to say, what was it that interested you about this topic of elder mistreatment in public health? Yes, ma'am.
I'm actually a psychiatry fellow in Brooklyn, New York, who bypassed the hurricane in California. But I actually have two patients right now in the state hospital. I'm a geriatric ward. They're open and adult protective services patients for possible elder abuse. So it just kind of brought it to mind that I have a very vulnerable population.
Wow. Thank you for being here, because you do have an extremely vulnerable population. Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
I'm a public health nurse, and I'm a nurse manager with the Riverside County Public Health Department, and we have an MOU contract with the Department of Public Social Services, and my program is the ABS program.
Oh, wow.
I deal with elder abuse, like, every single day.
Yeah, okay, great.
You are.
Yes.
But it's more of those are needed.
Yes.
Yes, and with money, we only have two nurses covering the entire county, which is ridiculous. But anyway.
Wow. Okay, it's Riverside, California. I think Riverside is like the second largest, geographically large county in the country. It's huge.
Yeah.
Anyone else? Why are you here today, yes, ma'am?
I'm just surrounded by elder abuse and the role that
the rise of elder abuse, which we'll talk about in just a second. Anyone else? In the back.
I was interested in elder abuse at home because I'm not in an institution as such, but I do have patients, and frequently they're the ones who are doing the abusing. But they're abusing things like not paying bills. So we had one patient that his mother was there and in the house, and so they didn't have any water.
Right. Okay. So we have neglect, and also we also see a lot of times neglect going hand in hand with financial abuse. If they're not paying water, is it because somebody's gambling the money over here or using it for drugs over there? So we'll talk a little bit. So part of my job is to kind of give you a little bit of a, for those of you who aren't experts in elder abuse, and you have two of the rock stars of the elder abuse world right here. I'm a rap singer when I'm not doing elder abuse work, so I'm not a rock star, but I might be a rap star if you're lucky. You might hear the There's No Excuse for Elder Abuse rap song. But just a little bit, in terms of context, I'm very interested in looking backwards as much as I am looking forwards. I think we have a lot of lessons to learn from our friends in child abuse and domestic violence and other kinds of injury prevention work. And I think, so we look back to see what have they done, where have they come from, what lessons have they learned. But just literally from a historical context, you know, you are all probably aware that the very first protection work, federal legislation related to protection of something that we might say is in the family, was about animals. So the SPCA and the ASPCA were the first prevention of violence organizations organized in America. So, you know, if you later meet me at the bar and there's a glass of Chardonnay, I'll tell you my stories about how I think what we need to do to raise the visibility of elder abuse is have every elder that we show with a puppy. because I think we might get some traction there. But in any case, so this was various kinds of legislation related to the protection of animals was first. And then in the 60s, we start to have the Federal Child Abuse Treatment Act. And we don't want to take anything away from our brothers and sisters who work in child abuse or who work in intimate partner violence in the 90s, the Violence Against Women Act was passed and just recently reauthorized for, I think, the third time at the federal level. Now, can anyone tell me when the first Elder Justice Act was passed in Congress? Besides you. Mary Ellen Coleman represents the Archstone Foundation, who has done a lot of funding in California on elder abuse, and we are grateful for them, but you know too much. You are not allowed to answer any questions. So the first, the Elder Justice Act, which is the first piece of federal legislation targeting elder abuse exclusively, was passed as part of the Affordable Care Act in 2010. So, you know, we think, oh, no, it must have been back when Social Security was created. Oh, no, it must have been back in the 40s. It must have been when Medicare was passed in the mid-60s. No, it took 7 years to pass. It's a fairly uncontroversial piece of legislation. And in terms of funding, let's talk about funding for elder justice. We have this lag time between animals, children, women, and elders, but elders are the fastest growing cohort of the population, especially the oldest old, who are some of the most vulnerable people. So we must have equity among, in terms of looking at family violence across the federal funding spectrum. But wait, I guess not. So again, not wanting to take a dime from anybody who does the good work preventing abuse or intervening with abuse of children or intimate partners, but we have a real disparity in terms of federal funding and right now. So the Elder Justice Act has not had any money appropriated for it since it passed in 2010. We are happy to have it passed. It was a little bit, as somebody said to me, it was a little bit of a Pyrrhic victory in that we have there's no money there. So if we were on my computer right now, when I click this next button, you would be hearing the Captain and Tennille sing Love Will Keep Us Together, because that was the number one hit in 1975. And because once I learned how to insert music in slides, it was all over. I just had to do it on almost every slide. But it's hard to do when you're using somebody else's computer. So the very first scholarly article actually called Elder Abuse Granny Bashing. It was published in 1975. So again, historically, it took till 2010 to get our federal legislation going, but scholars were starting to look at this incident of abuse in 1975. The National Center on Elder Abuse was established in 1989. In 1992, the first large incident study of elder abuse, which we'll talk about in a second, was mandated. The results were published in 1998. First National Academies report and the Elder Justice Act, that's what EGA is, was introduced into Congress. And the first request for a funding announcement by the National Institutes on Aging on Elder Abuse. So sort of going back to what Jeff was saying, we are sort of small and we want to increase our footprint. That's what I'm starting to talk. You know how we're all supposed to reduce our carbon footprint? I'm trying to use the opposite. I'm saying, how do we, whether we're in public health, whether we're in aging, like aging qua aging, whether we're in violence prevention, how do we increase our elder justice footprint? So 20 years ago, what did we know? And this is sort of the hopeful looking, starting to look ahead a little bit, to look back, to look ahead. 20 years ago, we knew not much at all. But what do we know now? A lot has happened in the last 20 years in elder abuse, and this is a little bit of a primer on sort of what do we know. We have a lot of work to do on incidence and prevalence data. Some of the things that I'm sure Dr. Hall and Dr. Teaster will talk about is how hard it is to reach elders. The results of this study, which is an Asierno study, was one of the drawbacks is that the first thing they did was ask people, they applied a little mini mental status exam, and if the person couldn't answer the questions, they couldn't pass the test. They were not asked whether the questions that made it into you have been abused, you haven't been abused. I'll have to figure out another easier way to say that, but you know what I'm saying. It didn't count people with dementia. How do we do incidence and prevalence data with people who are in long-term care institutions? Some great challenges in getting good data, but this is what I'm using as the National Center. 1 in 10 comes out to almost 5 million. And for every case that's abused, our lovely iceberg here, we know from a study that was just done in New York, but 23, in general, 23.5 cases of abuse were not reported for every one that was reported to Adult Protective Services or the police. So we also know that we're missing a lot of people. We don't know virtually anything about the efficacy of screening. What we know about screening, we're just hopefully taking from our brothers and sisters in domestic violence. But should we be screening every elder who comes, or every adult with a disability who comes into your clinic, your program? We don't know. If you meet me at the bar at 6 o'clock, I would say yes, but we don't have science yet. That's Jeff's job. He's going to give us some science. A study out of the University of California, Irvine, where I work, and almost exactly the same results out of a British study showed extremely high rates of abuse of people with dementia. Who told us that there were these really high rates of people with dementia? The caregivers. So this is, I think, an equally important result of this study is not so much equally to this high rate, was the fact that caregivers are telling us, yes, I've yelled at her. Yes, I've lashed out, which I think instructs the kind of work that you do. We've always been afraid of asking caregivers. We've always thought we had to ask the older person. What if the older person isn't cognitively competent to answer that? Elders are 3 times more likely to die than elders who are not abused. Elders who are abused are 3 times more likely to die than elders who are not abused. And the impact of abuse in a lot of different spectra are devastating, both to our medical system, our Medicaid, Medicare system, as well as to the seniors themselves. And this is a study that was actually done by Dr. Teaster, so I hope you're going to be talking about it, the MetLife study. So at a minimum, we know that about $3 billion is lost annually. We know a little bit more about who's abused, and this is sort of a picture of what I might go out on a limb to say is the sort of common picture of somebody who's abused. They are a woman who is over 80, who is has some sort of cognitive impairment or confused, and what we're learning more and more is the risk of social isolation as a predictor of elder abuse. We know a lot more than we did 20 years ago about who abuses. We actually thought for a long time that it was more that the abuse came about as a result of the care needs of the elder. So we would often say that, well, caregiver stress is what causes the abuse. But then we started to look at people who had very high levels of care need. And some of those people were not getting abused. And it didn't seem to correlate with how much care the person needed. What we then turned our attention to, well, who's providing the care? There are people who should not provide care. They are not capable of providing care to a vulnerable adult. And you know, I think that's a, this is again a more of a conversation for later, but that's one of the things that I know I look in my own heart about, would I be able to do this long term without getting so frustrated, so angry, you know. So we know most abusers are family members, and most abuse takes place in the community because, as all of you know, only about 5% of the elderly live in nursing homes or institutions at any given point. But it's really funny, or not funny, but kind of like revealing when you go talk to, for example, really young people, like in high school and college, you talk about elder abuse, and you say, what percentage of older people do you think live in the community or live in nursing homes? And they're like, 75%? I'm like, what, are you just not seeing them? And I think that's true. I think they are just not seeing the people walking the streets, in the parks, in the stores. We also, unlike our brothers and sisters in domestic violence, we also see that elder abuse is more of an equal, it's equalized in terms of perpetrators by gender. The vast majority of care in this country is provided by women, you know, wives and spouses, well, that's just wives, daughters, and daughters-in-law. And so they are in positions to abuse more, and it's about 48% of abusers are women, 52%. And this is, but this is data that one study showed us. We need to do more so we have a better picture. But we're starting to, the pieces of the puzzle, the frame of the puzzle is coming together. And so a study, back to a study we did at the University of California, Irvine, that the sort of, you know, when you were a Girl Scout or a Boy Scout and they taught you how to build a fire, you would put paper down or something that was really easy to burn, and then you would put the tinder and then the kindling, and you just needed a match. So this is the situation that just takes a match. You have a person who is providing care, who has untreated mental health issues, untreated drug and alcohol issues, who feels burdened. We're looking a lot more at resentment, the articulation of resentment as a predictor of abuse. Unlike sort of, we've always focused in the past on burden and depression, but I think we should be looking more at resentment. And they're providing care for somebody who is themselves physically or emotionally aggressive. So, and this may be because of a dementia or other cognitive issue, or it may be because, like me, they're going to grow up and be old and cantankerous and not very pleasant to be around. So I'm not saying that this is always, that the older person is not always just a result of a dementia. But this is the situation where it just would take one match to tip over into a fire. We know a lot more from the medical standpoint about forensic markers of abuse. So the first study ever done on bruising, nobody had ever looked at where do bruises occur in the elderly just from walking around all day. You know, we know a lot more about the, wait for it, and a round of applause would be appreciated, the pathognomonic signs of child abuse. We don't know, we know virtually nothing about those similar signs when it comes to elder abuse. But we do now know from two studies we did at the University of California, Irvine, any bruise on the face, if you look at the frontal picture, if I had the, this is location of bruises on abused elders, we have a similar slide of location of bruises on accidental bruises, none on the face. And the majority of people who were abused and had bruises to show for it remembered how they got that abuse. The people who had accidental bruising, like you and me, you get home and you're getting your pajamas on and you're like, what? How did that happen? So we are learning, this is a picture of the Los Angeles County Elder Abuse Forensic Center. So there are about six forensic centers for elder abuse around the country, four in California. And a study done by Dr. Adria Navarro showed that if a case, so this team meets once a week, and it includes Adult Protective Services, their long-term care ombudsman, police, sheriff, district attorney, mental health, a geriatrician, and a psychologist, among, and then other community-based providers. They have legal services, domestic violence services. If a case comes to that team, it is 10 times more likely to get prosecuted than if a case doesn't go to that team. Now, whether prosecution is the ultimate goal, in some cases, prosecution is the desired goal. We have bad actors who are going from one vulnerable adult to another. We want those people to be brought up before the criminal justice system. And if we think that elder abuse hasn't been much recognized in the public health realm, it is less recognized in the criminal justice realm. So teams like this are showing some efficacy in, not in prevention, but in intervention, in successful interventions. And if I had my cool audio component, the Beatles would be singing, "The Long and Winding Road," because that's what we're on, and that's why we're so happy that all of you are here to talk about the next piece. And I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Hall and Dr. Teaster, because you know what? Elder abuse has been pretty much a field. Nice field, right? Pretty flowers will grow up. Sometimes it yields some nice corn or something. But they are, in the end, standing still. Not anymore. In elder abuse, we are becoming a movement. And I'm calling it our elder justice movement. And to become a part of that, I think we were, oops, this is my old English spelling of the word lead. Yes, I was a classics major at Trinity, Oxford. We need to standardize our messages. To do that, we need better research. So we can say, this is the number. We need to, we were going to try to come up with all S words. We need to synergize. We need to partner with all of you and to collaborate in public health and figure out what's the best ways. We need to support each other. And then, like, if you're here, you're a leader in elder justice. You've just been deputized. When it was like a Harry Potter moment, when you came into this room, you became a leader in elder justice because, really, we need you. We need you to partner with us and to build energy around this issue and to not forget that when an elder comes into your clinic or into your program or you're doing community health outreach, that person who you used to see who's not coming anymore, don't just assume that it's because of just a mobility issue or just a health issue. What I say to people, and this dates me and dates, well, at least three of you in this room, remember My Favorite Martian? Okay, so My Favorite Martian, whenever Ray Walston became a Martian, he had these little antennae that came up in the back of his head, and the sound was like, whoop, 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 whoop. That's what I want to have happen for people who are working with elders and adults with disabilities, that you have that moment where you don't just say it's probably a physical health issue, it's maybe a psychological health issue, equally important and equally overlooked. Is it a violence issue? Is it a family violence issue? And the whoop, whoop, ask a few more questions. So come by and see us at booth 3006, where you can find a lot more information and learn about how to join our social justice grassroots movement, and visit us online. And so thank you, and let me hand you over to one of our rock stars.